with over a foot to spare on each side. Feeling somewhat shaky from the exertion, Aragon crossed his legs and rested his hands palm upward on his knees, allowing the air to soothe his torn skin. Below him lay the ruined city, a maze of shattered husks that often echoed with strange, forlorn cries. In a few places where there were ponds, he could see the faint, glowing lights of the bullfrog's lures, like lanterns viewed from a great distance. "Angler frogs," he thought suddenly in the ancient language. "That's what their name is, angler frogs." And he knew he was right, for the words seemed to fit like a key in a lock. Then he shifted his gaze to the cluster of stars that had inspired his climb. He slowed his breathing and concentrated on maintaining a steady, never-ending flow of air in and out of his lungs. The cold, his hunger, and his trembling exhaustion gave him a peculiar sense of clarity. He seemed to float apart from his body, as if the bond between his consciousness and his flesh had grown attenuated, and there came upon him a heightened awareness of the city and the island around him. He was acutely sensitive to every motion of the wind and to every sound and smell that wafted past the top of the pillar. As he sat there, he thought of more names, and though none fully described him, his failures did not upset him, for the clarity he felt was too deep-seated for any setback to perturb his equanimity. "How can I include everything I am in just a few words?" he wondered, and he continued to ponder the question as the stars turned. Three warped shadows flew across the city like small, moving rifts in reality, and landed upon the roof of the building to his left. Then the dark, owl-shaped silhouettes spread their barbed plumes and stared at him with luminous, evil-looking eyes. The shadows chattered softly to one another, and two of them scratched their empty wings with claws that had no depth. The third held the remains of a bullfrog between its ebony talons. He watched the menacing birds for several minutes, and they watched him in return, and then they took flight and ghosted away to the west, making no more noise than a falling feather. Near dawn, when Aragon could see the morning star between two peaks to the east, he asked himself, "What do I want?" Until then, he had not bothered to consider the question. He wanted to overthrow Galbatorix, that of course. But should they succeed, what then? Ever since he had left Palancar Valley, he had thought that he and Sephira would one day return, to live near the mountains he so loved. However, as he pondered the prospect, he slowly realized that it no longer appealed to him. He had grown up in Palancar Valley, and he would always consider it home. But what was left there for him or Sephira? Carvajal was destroyed, and even if the villagers rebuilt it some day, the town would never be the same. Besides, most of the friends he and Sephira had made lived elsewhere, and the two of them had obligations to the various races of Alagasia, obligations that they could not ignore. And after all the things they had done and seen, he could not imagine that either of them would be content to live in such an ordinary, isolated place. "For the sky is hollow, and the world is round. Even if they did return, what would they do? Raise cows and farm wheat?" He had no desire to eke out a living from the land as his family had during his childhood. He and Sephira were a rider and dragon. Their doom and their destiny was to fly at the forefront of history, not to sit before a fire and grow fat and lazy. And then there was Arya. If he and Sephira lived in Palancar Valley, he would see her rarely, if at all. "No," said Aragon, and the word was like a hammer blow in the silence. "I don't want to go back." A cold tingle crawled down his spine. He had known he had changed since he, Brom, and Sephira had set out to track down the Razak, but he had clung to the belief that at his core he was still the same person. Now he understood that this was no longer true. The boy he had been when he first set foot outside of Palancar Valley had ceased to exist. Aragorn did not look like him, he did not act like him, and he no longer wanted the same things from life. He took a deep breath, and then released it in a long, shuddering sigh, as the truth sank into him. "I am not who I was." Saying it aloud seemed to give the thought weight. Then, as the first rays of dawn brightened the eastern sky over the ancient island of Rohengard, where the riders and dragons had once lived, he thought of a name. A name such as he had not thought of before. And as he did, a sense of certainty came over him. He said the name, whispered it to himself in the deepest recesses of his mind, and all his body seemed to vibrate at once, as if Sephira had struck the pillar beneath him. And then he gasped, and then he found himself both laughing and crying, laughing that he had succeeded, and for the sheer joy of comprehension, crying because all his failings, all the mistakes he had made, were now obvious to him. And he no longer had any delusions to comfort himself with. "I am not who I was," he whispered, gripping the edges of the column. "But I know who I am." The name, his true name, was weaker and more flawed than he would have liked, and he hated himself for that. But there was also much to admire within it, and the more he thought about it, the more he was able to accept the true nature of his self. He was not the best person in the world, but neither was he the worst. "And I won't give up," he growled. He took solace in the fact that his identity was not immutable. He could improve himself if he wished, and right then he swore to himself that he would do better in the future, be it ever so hard. Still laughing, still crying, he turned his face toward the sky and spread his arms out to either side. In time, the tears and the laughter stopped, and in their place he felt a sense of deep calm, overlaid with a tinge of happiness and resignation. Despite Glaeder's admonition, he again whispered his true name, and once more his entire being shook from the force of the words. Keeping his arms outstretched, he stood atop the pillar, and then he tipped forward and fell head first toward the ground. Just before he struck, he said, "Veiled," and he slowed, rotated, and alit upon the cracked stone as gently as if he was stepping out of a carriage. He returned to the fountain in the center of the courtyard and retrieved his cloak. Then, as light spread through the ruined city, he hurried back toward the nesting house, eager to wake Sephira and tell her and Glaeder of his discovery. The Vault of Souls. Aragorn lifted his sword and shield, eager to proceed, but also somewhat afraid. As before, he and Sephira stood at the base of the Rock of Cuthien, while Glaeder's Heart of Hearts sat in the small chest hidden within the saddlebags upon Sephira's back. It was still early morning, and the sun shone brightly through large tears in the canopy of clouds. Aragorn and Sephira had wanted to go directly to the Rock of Cuthien once Aragorn had returned to the nesting house, but Glaeder had insisted that Aragorn eat first, and that they then wait for the food to settle in his stomach. But now they were finally at the jagged spire of stone, and Aragorn was tired of waiting, as was Sephira. Ever since they had shared their true names, the bond between them seemed to have grown stronger, perhaps because they had both heard how much they cared for each other. It was something they had always known, but nevertheless, to have it stated in such irrefutable terms had increased the sense of closeness they shared. Somewhere to the north, a raven called.
"I'll go first," said Glaeder. "If it's a trap, I might be able to spring it before it catches either of you."
Aragorn started to pull his mind away from Glaeder, as did Sephira, to allow the dragon to utter his true name without being overheard. But Glaeder said,
No, you have told me your names. It is only right you should know mine.
Eragon looked at Sephira, and then they both said, Thank you, Ebrithil. Then Gleda spoke his name, and it boomed forth in Eragon's mind like a fanfare of trumpets, regal and yet discordant, coloured throughout by Gleda's grief and anger at Oromus's death. His name was longer than either Eragon's or Sephira's. It went on for several sentences, a record of a life that had stretched over centuries and which had contained joys and sorrows and accomplishments too numerous to count. His wisdom was evident in his name, but also contradictions, complexities that made it difficult to fully grasp his identity. Sephira felt the same sense of awe upon hearing Gleda's name, as did Eragon. The sound of it made them both realize how young they still were, and how far they had to go before they could hope to match Gleda's knowledge and experience. I wonder what Arya's true name is, Eragon thought to himself. They watched the Rock of Cuthien intently, but saw no change. Sephira went next, arching her neck and pawing at the ground like a high-spirited charger. She proudly stated her true name. Even in the daylight, her scales again shimmered and sparkled at the proclamation. Hearing her and Gleda say their true names made Eragon less self-conscious about his own. None of them were perfect, and yet they did not condemn each other for their shortcomings, but rather acknowledged and forgave them. Again, nothing happened after Sephira uttered her name. Lastly, Eragon stepped forward. A cold sweat coated his brow. Knowing that it might be his final act as a free man, he spoke his name with his mind, as had Gleda and Sephira. They had agreed beforehand that it would be safer for him to avoid saying his name out loud, so as to reduce the chance that anyone might overhear it. As Eragon formed the last word with his thoughts, a thin, dark line appeared at the base of the spire. It ran upward 50 feet, and then split in two and arched down to either side, tracing the outline of 2 broad doors. Upon the doors appeared row after row of glyphs limned in gold, wards against both physical and magical detection. Once the outline was complete, the doors swung outward upon hidden hinges, scraping aside the dirt and plants that had accumulated before the spire since the doors had last opened, whenever that had been. Through the doorway was a huge vaulted tunnel that descended at a steep angle into the bowels of the earth. The doors ground to a halt, and the clearing fell silent again. Eragon stared at the dark tunnel, feeling a sense of increasing apprehension. They had found what they were looking for, but he still was not sure if it was a trap or not.
"Solomban did not lie," said Sephira.
Her tongue darted out as she tasted the air. "Yes, but what's waiting for us inside?" asked Eragon.
"This place should not exist," said Gleda. "We and the riders hid many secrets on Vroengard, but the island is too small for a tunnel as large as this to have been built without others knowing. And yet I have never heard of it before."
Eragon frowned and glanced about. They were still alone. No one was trying to sneak up on them. Could it have been built before the riders made Vroengard their home? Gleda thought for a moment.
"I do not know. Perhaps. It is the only explanation that makes sense. But if so, then it is ancient indeed."
The three of them searched the passageway with their minds, but they felt no living thing within it. "Right then," said Eragon. The sour taste of dread filled his mouth, and his palms were slick within his gloves. Whatever they were about to find at the other end of the tunnel, he wanted to know once and for all. Sephira was also nervous, but less than he.
Let us dig out the rat hiding in this nest, she said.
Together, then, they walked through the doorway and into the tunnel. As the last inch of Sephira's tail slid over the threshold, the doors swung shut behind them and closed with a loud crack of stone meeting stone, plunging them into darkness.
Oh, no, no, no,
growled Aragorn, rushing back to the doors.
Neina Havitr,
he said, and a directionless white light illuminated the entrance to the tunnel. The inner surfaces of the doors were perfectly smooth, and no matter how he pushed and pounded on them, they refused to budge.
Blast it!
We should have used a log or a boulder to wedge them open, he lamented, berating himself for not thinking of it beforehand.
If we have to, we can always break them down, said Sephira. That I very much doubt, said Gleda.
Aragorn re-gripped Brisinger. Then I guess we have no choice but to go forward.
When have we ever had any choice but to go forward?
Asked Sephira. Aragorn altered his spell so that the weir light emanated from a single point near the ceiling. Otherwise the lack of shadows made it difficult for him and Sephira to judge depth. And then, together, they started down the slanting tunnel. The floor of the passageway was somewhat knobbly, which made it easy for them to maintain their footing in the absence of steps. Where the floor and the walls met, they flowed together as if the stone had been melted, which told Aragorn that it was most likely elves who had excavated the tunnel. Down they went, deeper and deeper into the earth, until Aragorn guessed they had passed under the foothills behind the Rock of Cuthien and burrowed into the roots of the mountain beyond. The tunnel neither turned nor branched, and the walls remained utterly bare. At last Aragorn felt a hint of warm air rising toward them from farther down the tunnel, and he noticed a faint orange glow in the distance. Letter, he murmured, and extinguished the weir light. The air continued to warm as they descended, and the glow before them waxed in brightness. Soon they were able to see an end to the tunnel, a huge black arch that was covered entirely with sculpted glyphs, which made the arch look as if it were wrapped in thorns. The smell of brimstone tainted the air, and Aragorn felt his eyes begin to water. They stopped before the archway. Through it, all they could see was a flat, grey floor. Aragorn glanced back the way they had come, then returned his gaze to the arch. The jagged structure made him nervous, and Sephira as well. He tried to read the glyphs, but they were too jumbled and too densely packed to make sense of, nor could he detect any energy stored within the black structure. Yet he had difficulty believing that it was not enchanted. Whoever built the tunnel had succeeded in hiding the latch spell for the doors to the outside, which meant they could have done the same with any spells they had placed upon the arch. He exchanged a quick look with Sephira, and he wet his lips as he remembered what Gleda had said.
There are no more safe paths.
Sephira snorted, releasing a small jet of flame from the pit of each nostril. And then, as one, she and Aragorn walked through the archway. Lacuna, Part the First. Aragorn noticed several things at once. First, that they were standing at one side of a circular chamber over 200 feet across, with a large pit in the centre, from which radiated a dull orange glow. Second, that the air was stiflingly hot. Third, that around the outer part of the room were two concentric rings of bench-like tiers, the back one higher than the front, upon which rested numerous dark objects. Fourth, that the wall behind this tier sparkled in numerous places, as if decorated with coloured crystal. But he had no opportunity to examine either the wall or the dark objects, for in the open area next to the glowing pit, there stood a man with the head of a dragon. The man was made of metal, and he gleamed like polished steel. He wore no clothes other than a segmented loincloth, fashioned out of the same lustrous material as his body, and his chest and limbs rippled with muscles like those of a cull. In his left hand he held a metal shield, and in his right an iridescent sword that Aragorn recognized as the blade of a rider. Behind the man, set within the far side of the room, Aragorn vaguely saw a throne, with the outline of the creature's body worn into its back and seat. The dragon-headed man strode forward. His skin and joints moved as smoothly as flesh, but every step sounded as if a great weight was being dropped onto the floor. He stopped 30 feet from Aragorn and Saphira, and stared at them with eyes that flickered like a pair of crimson flames. Then, lifting his scaled head, he uttered a peculiar metallic roar that echoed until it seemed as if a dozen creatures were bellowing at them. Even as Aragorn was wondering whether they were supposed to fight the creature, he felt a strange, vast mind touch his. The consciousness was unlike any he had encountered before, and it seemed to contain a host of shouting voices, a great disjointed chorus that reminded him of the wind inside a storm. Before he could react, the mind stabbed through his defenses and seized control of his thoughts. For all the time he had spent practicing with Gleda, Arya, and Saphira, he could not stop the attack. He could not even slow it. He might as well have tried to hold back the tide with his bare hands. A blur of light and a roar of incoherent noise surrounded him as the yammering chorus forced itself into every nook and cranny of his being. And it felt as if the invader tore his mind into a half dozen pieces, each of which remained aware of the others, but none of which was free to do as it wished, and his vision fragmented, as if he were seeing the chamber through the facets of a jewel. 6 different memories began to race through his fractured consciousness. He had not chosen to recall them, they simply appeared, and they flew past faster than he could follow. At the same time, his body bent and flexed in various poses, and then his arm lifted Brisinger to where his eyes could see, and he beheld 6 identical versions of the sword. The invader even had him cast a spell, the purpose of which he did not and could not understand, for the only thoughts he had were those the other allowed. Nor did he feel any emotion, but that of fading alarm. For what seemed like hours, the alien mind examined every one of his memories, from the moment he had set out from his family's farm to hunt deer in the spine, 3 days before he had found Saphira's egg, up until the present. In the back of his mind, Aragorn could sense the same thing happening to Saphira, but the knowledge meant nothing to him. At last, long after he would have given up hope of release if he still had command of his thoughts, the whirling chorus carefully rejoined the pieces of his mind, and then withdrew. Aragorn staggered forward and dropped to one knee before he was able to regain his balance. Beside him, Saphira lurched and snapped at the air. "How?" he thought. "Who?" To capture both of them at once, and Gleda as well, he assumed, was something he did not believe even Galbatorix was capable of. Again, the consciousness pressed against Aragorn's mind, but this time it did not attack. This time it said,
"Our apologies, Saphira. Our apologies, Aragorn. But we had to be certain of your intentions. Welcome to the Vault of Souls. Long have we waited for you, and welcome to you as well, cousin. We are glad that you are still alive. Take now your memories, and know that your task is at long last complete."
A bolt of energy flashed between Gleda and the consciousness. An instant later, Gleda uttered a mental bellow that made Aragorn's temples throb with pain. A surge of jumbled emotions rushed forth from the golden dragon: sorrow, triumph, disbelief, regret. And overriding them all, a sense of joyous relief so intense, Aragorn found himself smiling, without knowing why. And brushing against Gleda's mind, he felt not just one strange mind, but a multitude, all whispering and murmuring.
Who?
Whispered Aragorn. Before them, the man with the head of a dragon had not shifted so much as an inch.
Aragorn, said Saphira, look at the wall, look.
He looked, and he saw that the circular wall was not decorated with crystal, as he had first taken it to be. Rather, dozens upon dozens of alcoves dotted the wall, and within each alcove rested a glittering orb. Some were large, some were small, but they all pulsed with a soft inner glow, like coals smouldering in a dying campfire. Aragorn's heart skipped a beat as comprehension dawned upon him. He lowered his gaze to the dark objects on the tiers below. They were smooth and ovoid, and appeared to have been sculpted from stone of differing colours. As with the orbs, some were large and some were small, but regardless of their size, their shape was one he would have recognised anywhere. A hot flush crept over him, and his knees grew weak.
It cannot be!
He wanted to believe what he saw, but he feared that it might be an illusion created to prey on his hopes. And yet the possibility that what he beheld was actually there took his breath away and left him staggered and overwhelmed to such a degree that he knew not what to do or say. Saphira's reaction was much the same, if not stronger. Then the mind spoke again.
You are not mistaken, hatchlings, nor do your eyes deceive you. We are the secret hope of our race. Here lie our hearts of hearts, the last free Eldunari in the land. And here lie the eggs that we have guarded for over a century.
Lacuna, Part the Second. For a moment, Aragorn was unable to move or breathe. Then he whispered,
Eggs, Saphira! Eggs!
She shivered as if with cold, and the scales along her spine prickled and lifted their tips slightly from her hide.
Who are you?
He asked the mind.
How do we know if we can trust you?
They speak the truth, Aragorn,
said Glaeda in the ancient language.
I know, for Oromis was among those who devised the plan for this place.
Oromis?
Before Glaeda could elaborate, the other mind said,
My name is Umaroth. My rider was the elf Vrail, leader of our order before our doom came upon us. I speak for the others, but I do not command them. For while many of us were bonded with riders, more were not. And our wild brethren acknowledged no authority but their own.
This he said with a hint of exasperation.
It would be too confusing for all of us to speak at once. So my voice will stand for the rest.
Are you? And Aragorn indicated the silvery dragon-headed man in front of him and Saphira.
Nay,
replied Umaroth.
He is Kuwarok, hunter of the Nidwal, and bane of the Urgals. Silvari the Enchantress fashioned for him the body he now wears, so that we would have a champion to defend us, should Galbatorix or any foes force their way into the Vault of Souls.
As Umaroth spoke, the dragon-headed man reached across his torso with his right hand, undid a hidden latch, and pulled open the front of his chest, as if he were pulling open the door to a cupboard. Within Kuarok's chest nestled a purple heart of hearts, which was surrounded by thousands of silver wires, each no thicker than a hair. Then Kuarok swung shut his breastplate, and Umaroth said,
No, I am over here.
And he directed Aragorn's vision toward an alcove that contained a large white Eldunari. Aragorn slowly sheathed Brisinga.
eggs and El Dunari.
Aragorn could not seem to grasp the enormity of the revelation all at once. His thoughts felt slow and sluggish, as if he had taken a blow to the head, which in a way he supposed he had. He started toward the tiers to the right of the black, glyph-covered arch, then paused before Kowarok and said, both out loud and with his mind, "May I?" The dragon-headed man clacked his teeth together and retreated with crashing steps to stand by the glowing pit in the center of the room. He kept his sword out, however, something of which Aragorn remained constantly aware. A sense of wonder and reverence gripped Aragorn as he approached the eggs. He leaned against the lower tier and released a shuddering breath while he stared at a gold and red egg that was almost 5 feet tall. Struck by a sudden urge, he peeled off a glove and placed the palm of his bare hand against the egg. It was warm to the touch, and when he extended his mind along with his hand, he could feel the slumbering consciousness of the unhatched dragon within. Saphira's hot breath passed along his neck as she joined him. "Your egg was smaller than this," he said.
"That is because my mother was not so old and not so large as the dragon who laid this one."
"Ah, I hadn't thought of that."
He looked out over the rest of the eggs and felt his throat tighten.
"There are so many," he whispered.
He pressed his shoulder against Saphira's massive jaw and felt the quivers coursing through her. She wanted, he could tell, nothing more than to rejoice and embrace the minds of her kin. But like him, she could hardly bring herself to believe that what she beheld was real. She snorted and swung her head around until she was looking at the rest of the room. And then she uttered a roar that shook dust from the ceiling.
"How?"
she growled with her mind.
"How could you have escaped Galbatorix? We dragons do not hide when we fight. We are not cowards to run from danger. Explain yourselves." "Not so loudly, Bjartskula, or you will upset the younglings in their eggs," chided Umaroth.
Saphira's muzzle creased as she snarled,
"Then speak, old one, and tell us how this can be."
For a moment Umaroth seemed amused, but when the dragon answered her, his words were somber.
"You are correct. We are not cowards, and we do not hide when we fight. But even dragons may lie in wait so as to catch their prey by surprise. Would you not agree, Saphira?"
She snorted again and lashed her tail from side to side.
"And we are not like the Fanghur or the lesser vipers who abandon their young to live or die according to the whims of fate. Had we joined the battle for Doru Areba, we would only have been destroyed. Galbatorix's victory would have been absolute, as indeed he believes it was, and our kind would have passed forever from the face of the earth. Once the true extent of Galbatorix's power and ambition became evident,"
said Gleda,
"and once we realized that he and the traitors with him intended to attack Froengard, then Vrail, Umaroth, Oromis and I, and a few others, decided that it would be best to hide the eggs of our race, as well as a number of the Eldunari. It was easy to convince the wild dragons. Galbatorix had been hunting them, and they had no defense against his magic. They came here, and they gave charge of their unhatched offspring to Vrail. And those who could laid eggs, when otherwise they would have waited. For we knew that the survival of our race was threatened. Our precautions, it seems, were well thought of."
Aragorn rubbed his temples.
"Why didn't you know of this before? Why didn't Oromis? And how is it possible to hide their minds? You told me it couldn't be done."
"It can't,"
replied Gleda.
or at least not with magic alone. In this instance, however, where magic fails, distance may yet succeed. That is why we are far underground, a mile below Mount Arolas. Even if Galbatorix or the Forsworn had thought to search with their minds in such an unlikely location, the intervening rock would have made it difficult for them to feel much more than a confused flux of energy, which they would have attributed to eddies within the blood of the earth, which lies close beneath us. Moreover, before the Battle of Doru Arriba, more than 100 years ago, all of the Eldunari were placed in a trance so deep as to be akin to death, which made them that much more difficult to find. Our plan was to rouse them after the fighting was over. But those who built this place also cast a spell that would wake them from their trance once several moons had passed. As it did, said Umaroth, the Vault of Souls was placed here for another reason as well. The pit you see before you opens onto a lake of molten stone that has lain beneath these mountains since the world was born. It provides the warmth needed to keep the eggs comfortable, and it also provides the light needed for us Eldunari to maintain our strength.
Addressing Glader, Aragorn said, You still haven't answered my question. Why didn't you or Oromis remember this place? Umaroth was the one who answered.
Because all who knew of the Vault of Souls agreed to have the knowledge removed from their minds and replaced with a false memory, including Glader. It was not an easy decision, especially for the mothers of the eggs, but we could not allow anyone outside this room to remain in possession of the truth, lest Galbatorix should learn of us from them. So we said farewell to our friends and comrades, knowing full well that we might never see them again, and that if the worst came to pass, they would die believing we had entered into the void. As I said, it was not an easy decision. We also erased from all memory the names of the rock that marks the entrance to this sanctuary, even as we had earlier erased the names of the 13 dragons who chose to betray us. I've spent the last 100 years believing that our kind was doomed to oblivion,
said Glader.
Now to know that all my anguish was for naught. I am glad, though, that I was able to help safeguard our race through my ignorance.
Then Saphira said to Umaroth,
Why didn't Galbatorix notice that you and the eggs were missing? He thought we were killed in the battle. We were but a small portion of the Eldunari on Froengard, not enough for him to become suspicious of our absence. As for the eggs, no doubt he was enraged by their loss, but he would have had no reason to believe trickery was involved.
Ah, yes,
said Glader sadly.
That was why Thuviel agreed to sacrifice himself, to conceal our deception from Galbatorix.
But didn't Thuviel kill many of his own? Said Aragorn.
He did, and it was a great tragedy, said Umaroth. However, we had agreed that he was not to act unless it was obvious that defeat was unavoidable. By immolating himself, he destroyed the buildings where we normally kept the eggs, and he also rendered the island poisonous to ensure that Galbatorix would not choose to settle here.
Did he know why he was killing himself?
At the time, no. Only that it was necessary. One of the Forsworn had slain Thuviel's dragon a month before. though he had refrained from passing into the void, as we needed every warrior we had to fight Galbatorix. Thuviel no longer wished to continue living. He was glad for the task then. It granted him the release he yearned for, while also allowing him to serve our cause. By the gift of his life, he secured a future for both our race and the Riders. He was a great and courageous hero, and his name shall someday be sung in every corner of Alagasia.
And after the battle, you waited,
said Saphira.
And then we waited,
Umaroth agreed. The thought of spending over 100 years within a single room, buried deep underground, made Aragorn quail.
But we have not been idle. When we woke from our trance, we began to cast our minds out, slowly at first, and then with ever greater confidence, once we realized Galbatorix and the Forsworn had left the island. Together, our strength is great, and we have been able to observe much of what has transpired throughout the land in the years since. We cannot scry, not normally, but we can see the skeins of tangled energy strewn across Alagasia, and we can often listen to the thoughts of those who make no effort to defend their minds. In that way, we have gathered our information. As the decades crawled past, we began to despair that anyone would be able to kill Galbatorix. We were prepared to wait for centuries more, but we could sense the Eggbreaker's power growing, and we feared that our wait might be one of thousands of years instead of hundreds. That, we agreed, would be unacceptable, both for the sake of our sanity and for the sake of the younglings in the eggs. They are bound with magic that slows their bodies, and they can remain as they are for years more. But it is not good for them to stay within their shells for too long. If they do, their minds can grow twisted and strange. Thus, spurred by our concern, we began to intervene in the events we saw. At first only in small ways. A nudge here, a whispered suggestion there. A sense of alarm to one about to be ambushed. We did not always succeed, but we were able to help those who still fought Galbatorix. And as time progressed, we grew more adept and more confident with our tampering. On a few rare occasions, our presence was noticed, but no one was ever able to determine who or what we were. Thrice we were able to arrange the death of one of the Forsworn. When not ruled by his passions, Brom was a useful weapon for us.
You helped Brom!
Aragorn exclaimed.
We did, and many others as well. When the human known as Hefring stole Saphira's egg from Galbatorix's treasure room, nigh on 20 years ago, we aided his escape, but we went too far, for he noticed us and became frightened. He fled and did not meet with the Varden as he was supposed to. Later, after Brom had rescued your egg, and the Varden and the elves started to bring younglings before it in an attempt to find the one for whom you would hatch, we decided that we should make certain preparations for that eventuality. So we reached out to the Weircats, who have long been friends of the dragons, and we spoke with them. They agreed to help us, and to them we gave the knowledge of the Rock of Cuthien and the Brightsteel beneath the roots of the Manoa tree. And then we removed all memory of our conversation from their minds.
You did all that from here? Said Aragorn, wondering.
And more. Have you never wondered why Sephira's egg happened to appear in front of you while you were in the midst of the spine?
That was your doing?
Said Sephira, her shock as strong as Aragorn's.
I thought it was because Brom is my father, and Arya mistook me for him.
Nay, said Umaroth. The spells of elves do not so easily go astray. We altered the flow of magic so that you and Sephira would meet. We thought there was a chance, a small one, but a chance nevertheless, that you might prove a fit match for her. We were right.
Why didn't you bring us here sooner, though? Asked Aragorn.
Because you needed time for your training, and otherwise we risked alerting Galbatorix to our presence before you or the Varden were ready to confront him. If we had contacted you after the Battle of the Burning Plains, for example, what good would it have done with the Varden still so far from Urubain?
There was silence for a minute. Aragorn slowly said, What else have you done for us?
A few nudges, warnings mostly, visions of Arya in Gilead when she needed your aid, the healing of your back during the Agaete Blodron.
A feeling of disapproval emanated from Gleda.
You sent them to Gilead, untrained and without wards, knowing that they would have to face a shade?
We thought Brom would be with them. But even once he died, we could not stop them, for they still had to go to Gilead to find the Varden.
Wait, said Aragorn. You were responsible for my transformation?
In part. We touched the reflection of our race that the elves summoned during the celebration. We provided the inspiration, and she, he, it, provided the strength for the spell.
Aragorn looked down and clenched his hand for a moment, not angry, but so filled with other emotions that he could not remain still.
Sephira, Arya, his sword, the very shape of his body. He owed them all to the dragons within the room.
Elrun Ono, he said.
Thank you.
You are most welcome, Shadeslayer.
Have you helped Roran as well?
Your cousin has required no assistance from us.
Umaroth paused.
We have watched both of you, Aragorn and Sephira, for many years now. We have watched you grow from hatchlings to mighty warriors, and we are proud of all you have accomplished. You, Aragorn, have been all we hoped for in a new rider, and you, Sephira, have proven yourself worthy of being counted among the greatest members of our race.
Sephira's joy and pride mingled with Aragorn's. He sank to one knee, even as she pawed at the floor and dipped her head.
Aragorn felt like jumping and shouting and otherwise celebrating, but he did none of those things. Instead, he said, My sword is yours.
And my teeth and claws, said Sephira.
To the end of our days, they concluded in unison. What would you have of us, Ebrithiller? Satisfaction came from Umaroth, and he replied,
Now that you have found us, our days of hiding are over. We would go with you to Urubain and fight alongside you to kill Galbatorix. The time has come for us to leave our den and once and for all confront that traitorous eggbreaker. Without us, he would be able to pry open your minds as easily as we did, for he has many Eldunari at his command.
I cannot carry all of you,
said Sephira.
You shall not have to, said Umaroth. 5 of us will stay to watch over the eggs, along with Quarok. In the event we should fail to defeat Galbatorix, they will tamper no more with the skeins of energy, but will content themselves with waiting until it is again safe for dragons to venture forth in Alagazia. But you need not worry. We shall not be a burden to you, for we will provide the strength to move our weight.
How many of you are there?
Asked Aragorn, gazing around the room.
136. But do not think we will be able to best the Eldunari Galbatorix has enslaved. We are too few, and those who were chosen to be placed within this vault were either too old and too valuable to risk in the fighting, or too young and too inexperienced to participate in the battle. That is why I elected to join them. I provide a bridge between the groups, a point of common understanding that otherwise would be lacking. Those who are older are wise and powerful indeed, but their minds wander down strange paths, and it is often hard to convince them to concentrate upon anything outside of their dreams. Those who are younger are more unfortunate. They parted from their bodies before they should have. Thus their minds remain limited by the size of their Eldunari, which can never grow or expand once it leaves the flesh. Let that be a lesson to you, Saphira, not to disgorge your Eldunari, unless you have reached a respectable size or face the direst of emergencies.
So we are still outmatched, said Aragorn grimly.
Yes, Shadeslayer. But now Galbatorix cannot force you to your knees the moment he sees you. We may not be able to best them, but we will be able to hold off his Eldunari long enough for you and Saphira to do what you must. And have hope. We know many things, many secrets, about war and magic, and the workings of the world. We will teach you what we can. And it may be that some piece of our knowledge will allow you to slay the king.
Thereafter, Saphira inquired of the eggs, and learned that 243 had been saved. 26 were set to be joined with riders. The rest were unbonded. Then they fell to discussing the flight to Urabain. While Umaroth and Gleda advised Saphira as to the quickest way to reach the city, the dragon-headed man sheathed his sword, laid down his shield, and one by one began to remove the Eldunari from their alcoves in the wall. He placed each of the gem-like orbs in the silk purse upon which it had been resting, then piled them gently on the floor next to the glowing pit. The girth of the largest Eldunari was so immense, the metal-bodied dragon was unable to wrap his arms all the way around it. As Quarok worked and as they talked, Aragorn continued to feel a sense of dazed incredulousness. He had hardly dared to dream that there were any other dragons hiding in Alagazia. Yet here they were, the remnants of a lost age. It was as if the stories of old had come to life, and he and Saphira were caught in the midst of them. Saphira's emotions were more complicated. Knowing that her race was no longer doomed to extinction had lifted a shadow from her mind, a shadow that had lain there for as long as Aragorn could remember. And her thoughts soared with a joy so profound, it seemed to make her eyes and scales sparkle brighter than normal. Still, a curious defensiveness tempered her relation, as though she was self-conscious before the Eldunari. Even through his days, Aragorn was aware of Gleda's change of mood. He did not seem to have entirely forgotten his sorrow, but he was the happiest Aragorn had felt him since Oromis had died. And while Gleda was not deferential to Umaroth, he treated the other dragon with a level of respect that Aragorn had not witnessed from him before, not even when Gleda had spoken with Queen Islanzadi. When Kuarok was nearly done with his task, Aragorn walked to the edge of the pit and peered into it. He saw a circular shaft that sank through the stone for over 100 feet, then opened onto a cave half filled with a sea of glowing stone. The thick yellow liquid bubbled and splattered like a pot of boiling glue, and tails of swirling fumes rose from its heaving surface. He thought he saw a light, like that of a spirit, flit across the face of the burning sea, but it vanished so quickly he could not be sure.
"Come, Aragorn," said Umaroth, as the dragon-headed man set the last of the Eldunari who were to travel with them upon the pile. "You must cast a spell now. The words are as follows."
Aragorn frowned as he listened. "What is the twist in the second line? What am I supposed to twist? The air?" Umaroth's explanation left Aragorn even more confused. Umaroth attempted again, but Aragorn still could not understand the concept. Other, older Eldunari joined in the conversation, but their explanations made even less sense, for they came mainly as a torrent of overlapping images, sensations, and strange esoteric comparisons that left Aragorn hopelessly bewildered. Somewhat to his relief, Saphira and Gleda seemed similarly puzzled, although Gleda said,
"I think I understand, but it is like trying to catch hold of a frightened fish. Whenever I think I have it, it slips out between my teeth."
At last, Umaroth said,
"This is a lesson for another time. You know what the spell is supposed to do, if not how. That will have to suffice. Take from us the strength needed and cast it, and then let us be off."
Nervous, Aragorn fixed the words of the spell in his mind to avoid making mistakes, and then he began to speak. As he uttered the lines, he drew upon the reserves of the Eldunari, and his skin tingled as an enormous rush of energy poured through him, like a river of water, both hot and cold. The air around the uneven pile of Eldunari rippled and shimmered. Then the pile seemed to fold in on itself, and it winked out of sight. A gust of wind tousled Aragorn's hair, and a soft, dull thud echoed throughout the chamber. Astonished, Aragorn watched as Saphira pushed her head forward and swung it through the spot where the Eldunari had just been. They had disappeared completely and utterly, as if they had never existed. And yet he and she could still feel the dragon's minds close at hand.
"Once you leave the vault," said Umaroth, "the entrance to this pocket of space will remain at a fixed distance above and behind you at all times, save when you are in a confined area, or when a person's body should happen to pass through that space. The entrance is no larger than a pinprick, but it is more deadly than any sword. It would cut right through your flesh were you to touch it."
Saphira sniffed.
"Even your scent has gone."
"Who discovered how to do this?" Aragorn asked, amazed.
"A hermit who lived on the northern coast of Alagasia 1,200 years ago,"
Umaroth replied.
"It is a valuable trick if you want to hide something in plain sight, but dangerous and difficult to do correctly."
The dragon was silent for a moment thereafter, and Aragorn could feel him gathering his thoughts. Then Umaroth said,
"There is one more thing you and Saphira need to know. The moment you pass through the great arch behind you, the gate of Vergathos, you will begin to forget about Kuarok and the eggs hidden here, and by the time you reach the stone doors at the end of the tunnel, all memory of them will have vanished from your minds. Even we Eldunari will forget about the eggs. If we succeed in killing Galbatorix, the gate will restore our memories. But until then, we must remain ignorant of them."
Umaroth seemed to rumble.
"It is unpleasant, I know. But we cannot allow Galbatorix to learn of the eggs."
Aragorn disliked the idea, but he could not think of a reasonable alternative.
"Thank you for telling us,"
said Saphira. And Aragorn added his thanks to hers. Then the great metal warrior, Kuarok, picked up his shield from the floor, drew his sword, and walked over to his ancient throne, and sat thereon. After laying his naked blade across his knees, and leaning his shield against the side of the throne, he placed his hands flat upon his thighs, and grew as still as a statue, save for the dancing sprites of his crimson eyes, which gazed out over the eggs. Aragorn shivered as he turned his back on the throne. There was something haunting about the sight of the lone figure at the far side of the chamber. Knowing that Kuarok and the other Eldunari who were staying behind might have to remain there by themselves for another 100 years or longer, made it difficult for Aragorn to leave. "Farewell," he said with his mind.
"Farewell, Shadeslayer,"
5 whispers answered.
"Farewell, Bright Scales. Luck be with you."
Then Aragorn squared his shoulders, and together he and Saphira strode through the gates of Argathos, and thus departed the Vault of Souls. Return. Aragorn frowned as he stepped out of the tunnel into the early afternoon sunlight that bathed the clearing before the Rock of Cuthien. He felt as if he had forgotten something important. He tried to remember what, but nothing came to mind, only a sense of emptiness that unsettled him. Had it to do with... No, he could not recall. "Saphira, did you..." he started to say, then trailed off.
"What?"
"Nothing. I just thought... Never mind. It doesn't matter." Behind them, the doors to the tunnel swung shut with a hollow boom, and the lines of glyphs upon them faded away, and the rough, mossy spire once again appeared to be a solid piece of stone.
"Come," said Umaroth. "Let us be away. The day grows long, and many leagues lie between here and Urubane."
Aragorn glanced around the clearing, still feeling as if he was missing something. Then he nodded and climbed into Saphira's saddle. As he tightened the straps around his legs, the eerie chatter of a shadow bird sounded among the heavy bowed fir trees to the right. He looked, but the creature was nowhere to be seen. He made a face. He was glad to have visited Vroengard, but he was equally glad to be leaving. The island was an unfriendly place.
"Shall we?"
asked Saphira.
"Let's,"
he said, with a sense of relief. With a sweep of her wings, Saphira jumped into the air and took flight over the grove of apple trees at the other side of the clearing. She rose quickly above the floor of the bowl-shaped valley, circling the ruins of Doru Areba as she climbed. Once she was high enough to soar over the mountains, she turned east and set off for the mainland and Urubane, leaving behind the remains of the Riders' once glorious stronghold. The City of Sorrows. The sun was still near its zenith when the Vardan arrived at Urubane. Roran heard the cries from the men at the head of his column as they crested a ridge. Curious, he looked up from the heels of the dwarf in front of him, and when he arrived at the top of the ridge, he paused to take in the view, as had each of the warriors before him. The land sloped gently downward for several miles, flattening out into a broad plain.